Tonight's episode of Fangoria's Colors of the Dark is brought to you by Welcome Villain Films and their new film, Mind, Body, Spirit. From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunt Her, Kill Her, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, coming to digital on May 7th. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda and produced by Dan Astma. Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister. As Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice, she unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos.
Now Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and Unnamed Footage Fest, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed horror film and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Amazon Prime and Apple Plus on May 7th.
Hello, and welcome to Fangoria's Colors of the Dark. I'm your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, and with me is Kane wearing a snazzy Mario Bava shirt tonight.
Regia did Mario Bava, made by our friend from the other podcast, Mr. Brian Sauer.
I need to order one of those shirts.
They're really cool. The hot tip, though, is what he's doing is he's taking either the start or final credit from the actual movie, so he's getting fun, obscure ones, so you're actually getting the right design of the fonts, but... The hot tip is I always pay the extra few bucks for the soft,
super soft.
Yeah, the super soft tri blend or whatever. And it makes such a, like, I love wearing them. Whenever I order the normal one, I wear it like once or twice and I'm like, eh. So this is
great. Yeah, I do not get thick cotton. And no. I know that there are t-shirt companies out there that's their thing is they want like the super thick cotton. And I am all like, that's why I love Fright Rags is they do like this super soft material. Yeah. And like our Fangoria shirts are so soft. I can't do that.
I think metal and horror are often worth a thick cotton style, right? A lot of shirts.
In the past.
And I think when I was younger, I didn't mind that as much, but I just like comfort.
Well, that was like the 80s. You wanted like the thicker cotton shirts, but yeah, I'm definitely not there. But hold on, my shirt.
Who? Oh, Sammy Kerr, who's a real heavy metaler.
Well done.
He's a real heavy metaler.
Yeah, we should talk about that. Right. He's a heavy metaler.
In my mind.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So, but yeah, that said, beautiful shirts. So you should check out, where is Brian Sauer selling these shirts?
They're on TeePublic, so it's an easy thing. You probably just have to look them up. I don't know what the exact tagline is. I was not prepared for this part. I'm just doing my part to rep. There's a couple I keep sneaking, like, oh, I'm gonna need a something t-shirt. I like the obscure ones for the most part, but I love the Mario Bava ones, got the cool font. So
I feel like I could teach in that and be totally comfortable for the day.
And I do have a t-shirt problem though. I'm starting to go, I need more houses to house t-shirts. I need to collect houses like Monopoly just so I can store old t-shirts, because it's the one thing I have too many of.
So this is my lame crafting tip here. A couple of months ago when I realized that my t-shirt drawer was overflowing, and a lot of them were horror shirts that I had like worn the hell out of, but because it had like Mario Bava on it, I was like, well, I can't get rid of it even if it's got holes or it's faded, because I love what's on it. And so I felt like personal to it. I cut them into squares and I have since started sewing them into an afghan. So I will have a t-shirt blanket of all of my old horror shirts. I need like four more to complete, so I'll have to wait for four more shirts to wear.
I'm not sure if that will quite work for me, but maybe I can make like a tent or something that I can.
How was your sewing skills?
I did it once when I was young, but
totally
I'm out
that.
Of practice. But yes, this is good. This will be like your Mario Koto. Is that what her name is? Where she folded all the clothes into small little bundles.
Marie Kondo.
I was in the ballpark.
Kondo. Marie Kondo.
I did try that for a while, and then even then
you tried folding your shirts into the
I did it just to try to save space, and then I was like, no, this is too much work. So it didn't work for me. But
Pyramid your pants.
yeah, I'm the kind of person who has two pairs of jeans, wears one pants every day forever, but then has like 1,000 t-shirts. So just my luck.
Nice. Okay, so let's dive into what we watched this week. So you watched some stuff that was like catch up,
Yes,
things
so
that
new
I had
movies
discussed.
that you had already talked about that we don't always time this perfectly. So,
We don't.
and both are really cool. So I'll just start with those two because they're both actually both really good films. So, Late Night with the Devil, I caught up because it just came to Shudder, and I thought it was really effective. It was one of the first movies I have seen in a very long time where I think it suited the TV format better than it would have theatrical. You know, like often I'm like, yeah, see a movie theatrically, but watching this on TV because it is a 1977 talk show syndicated, you know, called Night Owls, and they're trying to recreate this. It really worked just watching it on TV. I thought Deshmalian's performance was great, and I just thought the whole thing was cool. I didn't know much about it. I actually went into it assuming that he was playing the devil, like just without any trailers. My brain goes to, oh, he's the devil, and he's going to do something evil. So I didn't realize he's, you know, playing a character who there's forces happening on the as a live possession is enacted on TV. But what I will say is, like, it was one of those things where I'm like, it's solid, it's all good, and then there's a 10-minute or so sequence that's just like top shit, like really good, like when it hits towards the end, there's a little denouement at the end that seems to take some people, like somebody I watched it with, it kind of took them out of the movie.
Say that one more
The
time.
denouement, the end part, you know, the what's
I always call it the denouement.
You're probably correct. I mean, that sounds French. Denouement is probably what they said in the Old West. They're like, eh, the denouement. But I don't know. But that part didn't bother me. I thought it was emotionally still right, like for the character in the movie. But there is something to be said for this is one of those movies that like could have just cut out at the wildest moment and just cut to black, and it would have fucking worked.
At any point, I would have been fine with that.
But it's a really cool movie. So if you haven't seen it yet, I was, you know, not too late. I just saw it when it hit Shudder. Really, really solid. And again, as proving we're in a, I mean, the movies I'm going to be talking to, about today, I think we already have better horror films than we had last year, and it's April. I don't know if I have really my personal faves yet, but I can tell this is going to be a banner year when we get to the end.
Like between even just some of the theatrical stuff that we've seen, I'm already feeling. Whereas last year it was very much like, I guess I could scrape together a
It was,
list.
yeah,
Like
it
I
was a little tough.
wasn't really sure on it. This year I'm feeling like I'm gonna have a lot to pick
Yeah,
from.
like I said, it's we just finished April, and it's May 1st when we're recording this, and it's like there are some really great movies. And the second one, which just was so much fun to watch, and rare because animal attacks, especially spider movies, are usually funny and humorous and lighthearted
Yes.
and infested, even though people.
Dead
Yeah, even though you
serious.
can throw around the attack the block kind of setting, it really is, and characters in a way, this is a dead serious and you know, very realistic version of that. And I was shocked how good the spiders looked. Like, I just don't know the last time I saw CG where I was like, of course, as they get bigger and bigger, it becomes a little less realistic. But when they are small, it just, I mean, if somebody had said, no, they're all real spiders, I would believe it because it just was so well done. But this amazing and what an incredible building with a crazy circular structure. A young guy who's into keeping pets and animals and exotic things has brought home the spider that in the opening scene you saw got caught in, I think it's in Iran.
It was a great cold
Yeah,
open. It was
very.
somewhere in the Middle East, and you know that these spiders are vicious, but he catches one and sells it like it's a bootleg
Yeah, and
pet.
then he takes it home and he meet his friends, and he's, you know, he's dealing with the situation with the loss of a parent with his sister, and just, you know, they're in their, I guess, 20s. It was kind of hard to tell some of that, but there's no exposition. It's the kind of movie that just you jump in, you get to know the characters, and in this apartment building you meet some of the people, and then before you know it, this thing has just multiplied so fast that within 20 minutes of this movie the entire building has been taken over, and like Wreck has been quarantined so they can't leave. And there are just some sequences, just little moments that are really unsettling, really disturbing. I found it a little, I think it would have been in contention for like top one or two of the year for me if I had stopped watching at the, you know, with like 20 minutes to go. I think the last act was a little more familiar. Like it becomes a little bit more like Wreck movies and things like
It
that.
does.
Whereas the rest was so, I mean, I was on, we were, I just was kind of like floored by the kind of pacing and intensity of the spider. So it's still a great, really great movie, and one of the first scary spider films I can think of in a long time. Spiders can be scary, but usually funny.
I think you called it the final act for me after people are getting infected and it becomes much more about who's been bit. It felt like a zombie film for
Yeah,
me.
it's just a little more familiar. And with a house, an apartment on lockdown, and
The siege and all the military there, and it becomes them versus the military versus who's become bit and infected. That it felt more like a wreck, but it was still a
still
really
really good.
good
It
wreck.
never weakens. It's just the pacing. You're at such a high level for so much of this movie. It's just sequence to sequence of them exploring, trying to figure out how to survive. And yeah, so for people who haven't checked that out, that's definitely high up in this year's horrors, and something I felt like I hadn't seen in a while, you know?
Those spiders kicked so much ass. And I love that we're getting spider films
Yeah.
again because they obviously kind of wax and wane in popularity. And I love spiders, both as my fuzzy tarantula pets, who are very, very sweet. And I love my cinematic spiders as well.
And I
So I'm
recommend a
excited to
film
see
for
them
you,
back.
a little film called Camel Spiders, starring not starring me, but me,
I
you
was going to
know.
say, aren't you in
Yeah, my
that?
first, and I was telling somebody because I wondered at the start if that was what they're kind of alluding to in Iran with their catching spider, because camel spider, it's
Same.
kind of a lore. But yes, that was my first week in Los Angeles, moving here, was getting to play both the, or I guess we were like soldiers, American soldiers shooting, and then we changed costume and we became the I guess we were, I think we were from Iran, I can't remember, but we were like shooting back, and the whole thing was a real lesson in independent filmmaking, where I was like,
You
oh
get to play
yeah,
both
you got to play
sides.
it's Jim Warnowski.
I
So
remember the camel spider mythos being released online, and there was even like, and this was such like urban internet legend that I remember happening when I was probably still in college, but it was spreading of like, and it was a very kind of not necessarily doctored, but I'll say like filmed in a very specific way, picture of somebody holding a spider really close to camera, but it looked like it was the size of his goddamn leg in the picture. And then along with it was this mythos about the camel spiders that supposedly jumped out of the sand and slit camels' bellies
yeah.
open, and that's how they hunted. And then you're looking at this picture online of like this spider the size of a human leg, and you're like, fuck. And then I remember that was probably one of the first times that I snoped something, where I like went to Snopes and was like, camel spiders. And they're like, no, it's all fake. You know, they exist, but they're not quite like that. But still, yeah, it's that's a beautiful lore turned to movie. So I must watch your performance as
Yeah, I don't
both
even know if you'd see it
sides.
for a second or something like that, but it was still fun. It's fun, always fun to see how just how low budget, especially these kind of people like Warnowski shoot, because you know he's probably had he it probably it was probably a big come down from when he was shooting on film, you know, to have to suddenly
Oh
go do these
gosh.
movies in a few days probably.
I feel like he ruled with it. Like he
Yeah.
just rolls and, you know, works. But
Yeah.
okay, let's dig into some of the stuff that we both watch. So, let's start with kind of the big, what I'm going to call the water cooler discussion of the week, which was Baby
Oh,
Reindeer,
wow.
which I'm
Yeah.
going to say adjacent horror. Like, at no point did I feel like this went full horror, but let me just say it was like 1 degree away from like Misery. And so
Yeah.
we decided that we were still going to cover it just because it does have this kind of intense Misery quality to it.
Yeah, I mean it's a story, it's a what a 4 or 5 part, I can't recall,
I think it was six part
story. I don't know,
episode.
because I watched it in one sitting because I
Two
couldn't get up
nights.
afterwards.
Yeah, same. 2 nights. I watched the first four in the first night, and then I did like the next two or so the next
Yeah,
night.
ostensibly it's a Scottish comedian who is basically working at a bar, moves to London to try to make it, and works at a bar. And one day a woman comes in who doesn't want anything and has no money, and he's just nice to her and gives her, you know, some water or tea, offers her some
I
tea,
see.
and that's enough to trigger her to basically become completely obsessed with everything about him and misinterpret every single sign. But what makes it, I think, a rich, like honestly, I thought it was one of probably the best thing I've seen this year so far, of any format. And I think it was the honesty to which he makes himself not look good is what makes it special, because he doesn't just say she's fucking psycho. He goes, she's fucking psycho, but I also might have been encouraging it because of my own lacks in my life, my own
Not
problems.
might. Like he owns up to
Yeah.
it. He's like, I definitely was encouraging this because I had these issues with self-esteem and other things. And he really delves into it. And he doesn't paint himself as a great character. My love of it came out of how it balanced tone,
Yeah.
because it ranged in every like 25 to 30 minute episode, and they were only 30 minute episodes. It would be scary. It would be hilariously funny. And then it would be like awkwardly uncomfortable down to, oh my God, this is like devastating. Like there was just this incredible range of emotions and the way that the content was being handled, but it all somehow tonally meshed together, which is the weirdest thing if you're thinking about how much he was covering and how at times it was hilariously funny, and then other times it just was so heart-wrenching.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real, careful one foot in trauma, lots of different types of trauma being discussed, and surprising reactions to trauma that I found to be particularly fascinating and honest. And yeah, it's a real blind, because on the surface, it reminded me of like, oh, a Fleabag, but then it goes so much darker and so much more, like poke at your own wounds, that it really is something unique. So if people haven't checked it out, I'm very glad I did. I was hearing about it, but I might have waited another few months because I thought it was maybe a light comedy or something.
Nah, I poked you till you
Yeah,
did.
no, it's really good.
Yeah. So, Baby Reindeer, that's on Netflix right now. Definitely worth checking out.
Okay, then I'll bring up the Tubi one that we both watched, because this one I had heard. So somebody said, oh, there's this really great new film on Tubi. We are going to say very little, then we'll put a big spoiler warning and decide if we're going to say any more or we won't, because it's such a movie that really it
It's
moves on the hinge of
such.
its great twist. And I did talk to the filmmaker when I posted about this on Instagram, wrote to me, one of them, Mitch Oliver, and he did. I asked about how do you hide good twists, and because obviously Abigail was unable to, because the marketing did not let those, the filmmakers wanted to, but
I've
the
heard so
marketing
many
did not.
arguments. I'm going to take a sidebar here really quick and we'll go back to talking about twists in a sec. But I have heard so many people saying, like, I can't believe that they revealed like the big hook of Abigail in the trailer. And I'm like, think about what that would have been marketing wise without that. It just would have been group of people abduct girl.
No, I mean,
Like, you don't have a
Well,
movie.
it's this is the pro there's a problem. I think the movie would be, marketing people's fear is, oh, if we market that, no one's gonna go. And that might be true initially, but if those who do go, it's gonna be the best film of the year. The experience is gonna be so mind-blowingly good that now word of mouth goes a long way. And there's examples of this, because like From Dusk Till Dawn did not leak the stuff. It was like, oh my God, this is a vampire film, and you didn't see it coming. So I think I understand why marketing doesn't do it, but I think they're wrong. And I think marketing needs to grow a pair or take bigger risks. Again, you can't take a risk on everything you put out, but I think that particular kind of movie would have been worth taking risks, because it's still a good movie. The people who say I didn't
See,
like it because I knew the twist, that's a little silly, because it's a
I
fun movie.
disagree. I think that they had to show the twist. And this wasn't
But no
just
one
the
went.
marketing
But
side
so
of
it's
me.
already failed. It
Are
totally
you
no, it didn't
serious? I didn't even pay attention to the box
No,
office
I mean
this week. Oh my
it
God.
made some money, but it's definitely way underperformed.
Oh,
That's what
that
I'm
breaks
saying.
my
No, if
heart.
it had worked, I would have been like, who cares? But that's what I'm saying. Like, if you had hidden it, it might still have failed, but the word of mouth would have been incredible, because people would have been, it would have become the water cooler. It should be the water cooler movie. But instead, everyone was talking about, and when you talk about ballerina vampire movie, that to me and you, super cool. There's a lot of people in this country who'd go, ugh, I don't want to watch a ballerina. But if they had seen it in the theater, they would have been like,
It's
wow.
so fun and
Marketing's weird. We're in a weird time
bonkers.
because we have to overexplain everything, and that I don't think works great with movies. I think movies are great for just get enough of a hook. But you're right. The fundamental problem is now, yes, you're peddling a crime movie, not a horror movie, and that's not even the right show. So it's tough. But Abigail ruled. It was super fun.
It was great. It was
But
probably one, it's going to be in my top 10 of the year, I have a feeling. So,
yeah.
y'all should go see it if you did not already.
So anyway, what
Okay,
I will
so
say
back
is,
to heavy
yes,
twists
so
in
this movie
movies,
called
because
Low
Lowlifes
Lives.
has
Yeah,
one.
Low Lives, and we won't get into it. But the director said they had to really, really convince and beg Tubi not to give it away, and they agreed. And that's fantastic. So we won't either. But basically, it opens with this, clean cut, like very, suburban type
Standard
family. Yeah,
family,
standard traveling across America. They are set up in their RV camper, having their barbecue, and their daughter's kind of, feels like a It Follows type character. She's kind of wandering around, seems like she's a little adrift of the family.
She keeps texting her friends. Like, she definitely wants to be somewhere else. There's all these discussions amongst the family about how she used to really enjoy these trips, and now she doesn't seem to.
And then basically they then two Hicks, classic movie hick characters roll up to them, ask if they've seen their buddy, and then they just are kind of menacing and weird, and it's very tropey. I could have almost turned it off not long. Like, I'm the type who could have gone, okay, I know what this is going to be.
Had you not told me to stay with it, I
Yeah,
would have
I
turned it
did tell
off
you
at
that.
that
Yeah, I
point.
was
So you were like, stay with
anyone I
it.
could
And so,
tell right after that. I was like, and
yeah.
then the family continue down the road, kind of leave after an awkward, almost going, oh, is this going to go deliverance? They get out of there, but there's tension. And the deal is they'll take one of the Hicks. One of their car's broken down. They're asking for help. They say, well, we won't both come with you because it's obviously a threatening situation. They're even carrying a shotgun. One of us will go with you. Take us back to the house, and we'll go from there. And the family end up taking him. The family have to stay in this house with their family, their extended Hick. I'm putting that in quote marks to not be degrading,
Thanks.
and not to you, but anyway. And they have to spend the night, and then shit gets bonkers. And there's no other way
Yeah.
to talk about this movie really without spoiling everything.
Yeah, no, and I don't think that we need to give like a big spoiler here. I think we can just end it with, and once they get to the house to spend the night with the more rural family, shit gets really bonkers. And then we have some really big twists in there that made me completely reevaluate the entire movie, and it makes it so good. It's very much like A Martyrs, where the movie literally reinvents itself as it's going along because we keep getting these massive twists,
We'll
which is
table it
just
for
great.
now, and then maybe
Couple
2 weeks from now, when we do our next
episodes,
show, we will just talk about purely spoilery. So if you are
yeah,
interested in jumping in, do it
the
now,
twist.
because it's saying I do want to. This is a frustrating thing about movies. There's nothing more I want to talk about this week than this movie.
This movie,
And
I've
especially for it
been.
to be original, it's rare. Like, we've seen a couple of our friends make them where it's like, oh, they're better than I would have expected to be. And this is one of the first I've seen where I was genuinely surprised by to be
I
like this
think
is a surprising
all
movie.
or nothing but eyes or all eyes. I can't
That
remember
wasn't
the
made for
eye
them
one.
though. It was
Oh, it
just a
wasn't.
pickup, yeah. So it's that was just an independent film,
Was
yeah.
this a Tubi
This
original or
I
was
this was
this a
made for no,
pickup?
this one was made for them. So, or
Okay.
at least that's how when I asked the director, he was talking about Tubi specifically and how it was marketed. So if not made for them, it was, they had to deal with
Picked
them.
up by them and it
Yeah.
became a Tubi
And they
original.
actually,
That's.
if the people who made this, or at least, pardon me, he the director wrote Influencer that we covered. He didn't direct it, but he was the writer of Influencers,
Oh, that
which is
was a
also a cool
great
movie. So,
movie. We enjoyed that.
yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway,
So,
watch it. Lowlifes.
yeah, this is on Tubi now, so you can all watch it completely for free. This was great. I had a really good time with this one, and it just had really baller twists throughout. So,
I'm surprised, yeah.
Lowlifes on Tubi. Okay.
I got one I want to ask you about if you had ever heard. I had never heard of this back in the day, but my friend Dick explained. On Hulu right now, there's a brand new Micah Monroe, who's just, I'll watch anything she's in horror related, horror film called The Stranger. And I was like, what? I don't know this. And it looked, then when I started looking at it, she looked, a couple years younger. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Directed by Verena Sud, who, when I looked her up, did the series The Killing, which I loved, one of my favorite shows. And it's basically a
What
right.
year is
Well,
this?
that's the thing. It's this year. It's brand new. Just went to
What?
Hulu. But here's the fun part. This is why I wondered if you might have heard of it back then. I did not know about this. This was 13 episodes of a show for Quibi. And it's just one straight. And then when Quibi failed, I don't even know if these all would have played at the time because I don't know how long it existed. But just now it has been reconstructed to just be a feature film and put as a brand new film on Hulu. So, and you
Wow,
can't
that
really
would.
tell. Like, it feels just like a normal feature. There's nothing about it that seems. There's a couple moments where maybe you could. I could see why it would work very well as segments, to be honest, because it's maybe more believable in installments than as a 2 hour film. But it was still cool to see a brand new Micah Monroe stalker movie. And I thought it was pretty decent, to be honest, and
You know,
liked it.
I feel like we're far enough away from Tubi now that I
Oh,
can talk about
Quibi, yeah.
something, or sorry, Quibi, that I can talk about some of the weirdness of Quibi. So there was a stretch where Quibi was really trying to get a lot of horror, and they would bring a lot of horror people, myself included, into pitch. And it was the weirdest structure because they were breaking it up into 3-minute segments, which they called quibbies. So you would come in and you would pitch something, but you were pitching it as 3-minute episodes. And then within each one of those 3-minute episodes, there had to feel like a 3-act arc. So basically, you're trying to create like a rise and fall every 3 minutes of screen time. And it was really bizarre way to approach shows. It wasn't just, that they were chopping things up into like these little or 7 minutes, however long the quibbies were. It wasn't just that they were chopping them up into these tiny pieces, but if you glued it all together, it was one consecutive show. I think that some of them ended up like that because I've watched some of the 50 States of Fear that do track like that just feel like, it was one solid piece, but it was divided up.
And yet, all
That's
these
not
years,
how they were.
but all these years later, that's exactly how young people are now watching movies on TikTok. People are
Right?
sharing tiny little pieces. I mean, I
Tiny
couldn't
little
do it,
pieces.
obviously, but
Yeah.
obviously they had the correct idea maybe for some of this.
Yeah. So, okay. Now that I know that this is the series of quibbies stitched back together,
One
how does
continuous
it
story.
play?
So, well, that's the
How does
thing.
it play in
I
full?
bet you it will play differently knowing that. I didn't know that when I pushed play. I was just like, oh, Micah Monroe. Looking back, these would have been probably 8 minute segments. It probably is
I think it was 7 to 8 minutes.
for
I can't
this, it would
remember
be
what the
eight probably,
original pitch was.
but
Yeah.
it makes total sense because it's quite heightened at the end of each one. And so when you then stitch it together as a feature, there's a lot of rises, you know what I mean? And so maybe it's a little less, but I found it the setting fun. So basically it's Micah Monroe has just gotten to LA, like only been there like a week, and she's doing rideshare and she's a driver, and she goes to this mansion and picks up this young guy played by Dane DeHaan, and he just gets in and he goes, oh, can I sit in the front? Because they're sitting in the back, and she's a little unsure, but lets him, and he looks pretty innocent, and they start talking, and there's just like they're vibing in the first couple of minutes. You're like, oh, there might even be a connection here. And then he just says to her, yeah, oh, that wasn't my house. No, I just killed that family. And you should have heard their kids when I killed them. And she's just like, oh, fuck. And now he's in her car. So it's a total stalker. And he's just basically then, as it goes throughout the night, it's kind of like that one Run All Night that we watched a couple years ago, where there's a psychopath basically almost controlling events.
Run,
Run,
sweetheart,
Sweetheart, Run,
run.
which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's got some fun stuff.
Yeah,
Good,
that was
great
a good
performance.
movie.
It
Yeah.
has a very much that kind of structure. Knowing the thing about the segments probably would change how I would watch it again, but not knowing that, I was just like, oh, this is felt like a cool indie festival film that I had missed and had Micah Monroe, who's always great. There's a couple plausibility, moments, of course, but that's probably partially because it was being made for as a short form series. But it's just interesting that it's not being, no, you wouldn't know this advertising wise. It just kind of appeared on Hulu, a brand new horror film with her. And I was like, huh, that's curious. So reading about it was fun. But I did ask my friend Dick, and he was like, oh no, I watched it when it was a Quibi thing. Back then, I don't know if it played all
He
that.
was the only
He might
viewer.
have
He
been.
was
He
their
might have
one.
been the one. So, but I, it does, it makes you, it is a shame sometimes because I know, like, even the first show I did that was called This Week in Horror, even that was a few years ahead of people watching live TV on the internet, if you know what I mean. Like, it was a little too soon and it didn't work because of that. I think now, if Quibi, like, was hitting right the second, obviously, they also made financial decisions probably that helped to their demise and stuff. But I do think something like that could work now. And would be kind of interesting.
This has become a bigger conversation as we have just within the past month or two heard from a number of outfits that are stopping Blu-ray and DVD releases.
Ooh.
Places like Disney and Best Buy is not going to carry them anymore. And so we're basically at this point looking at boutique labels and online streaming as being our two kind of only sources for movies. And I have seen so many conversations popping up about media graveyards. And Tubi was one of them, that Tubi had created all this content, like the 50 States of Fear
Oh,
and this thing. And sorry, Quibi. I
They're
keep
very
saying
close.
Tubi.
They're
My bad. My bad. My brain.
yeah.
And it's been a long day. So Quibi is now being discussed as one of them, as like somebody who had created all this content that will never exist in a physical form. But as soon as they went under, what happened to the content? And it's weird to think about that, but like, think like if tomorrow, and it's not going to happen, but this is kind of the big scale one. If tomorrow Netflix just went bankrupt and they just shuttered their doors, what happens to all of their original programming? Because most of it has never had any type of physical releases, it just dies with it. So it's kind of the idea of, this is now a streaming graveyard, and the idea of, that we are forced to kind of see who is licensing specific titles at any given point to figure out where we need to go watch stuff, and it dictates our viewing. It's not like I just want to see The Thing tonight. It immediately becomes an evaluation of where The Thing is streaming, Do I belong to those? Am I willing to join this thing for another $7.99 a month just to watch this film that is now there? And so it's
This is why
weird
the tagline
conversations.
for should be nothing ever really does, Becca. It just goes to Tubi because
it just goes to
because
Tubi.
Even my show, the show we did, it's like, even that somehow
it's on Tubi.
Did I license it? No, I did not. So why is it on Tubi? I don't know, but it's
I
there.
Have films on Tubi
this is
that I didn't know existed until my students were like, "Hey, you know your movies are on Tubi," and I was like, "Really? I have like a Lifetime film on Tubi. I think my first one, Creatures, is on Tubi." Yeah,
pretty
like
cool. I actually like that.
We
I
all.
like that about Tubi. It's Wild West sometimes. You don't know what will be there. You don't know what's leaving. But this one's on Hulu, formerly Quibi. I also don't think Quibi is, like you just said it wrong a couple times, because I don't think it's as easy to come off the mind. Like Tubi,
It isn't.
Quibi's, it's just nothing. Sorry.
It lasted. It had like a minute.
I think it was only a minute. I think it was a couple, few months, wasn't it?
I mean, I definitely went to their offices a few times because we were talking about building things out. I definitely pitched there a couple of times. So I feel like they had a couple of years lead up and then maybe like a 2-year launch trying to get off the ground.
Yeah.
It didn't. It was maybe 5 years of
R.I.P.
work.
Quibi.
So.
But now you can see The Stranger, which is also a very generic title. I don't know if that was the name of it as a show, just The Stranger on Hulu. And it was fun.
Okay.
Not the masterpiece, but fun.
Quibi on Hulu.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to actually take us to Tubi now.
Okay.
Because after I finished watching Low Lives, it does that thing where it's like, you may also like, and then it popped up this movie called Cram. And I was like, huh, what's that? Okay. And then the next day, and this is where kind of kismet of the universe comes in, somebody tagged me in a post and it was something like my favorite weird movies. And it was My Film Glorious, Pussycake, which is on Screenbox, which is great and really fun and weird. And I enjoyed that one. And then also Cram again. And I was like, well, if the universe has brought me this movie two times within a 24-hour period, I need to see this movie. So log back into Tubi and I decided to watch Cram. This is from 2021 and this is straight fucking liminal horror. So if you are big into your Skinamarinks or your Outwaters or your Dims or what was the Dimlands, that is what this is. This is straight liminal horror. It is a very simplistic setup. It's only 45 fucking minutes long as well, which I'm going to say, if you're going to make a liminal horror, perfect time.
Yeah, they always
perfect
outstay
time.
Their welcome a bit.
Because my biggest complaint with both Skinamarink and Outwaters was I was in, loved the concept, was with you for the nightmare logic, could have taken 20 minutes off of it. 45 minutes for this was great. So the setup, very simplistic, about a college student who is in the library at his university writing his final term paper, and he's cramming. And it's like midnight, the night before it's due, and he's there cramming and he doesn't know what to do. And it's not writing very well, but he's able to squeak out a couple of pages and then he falls asleep and he's startled awake a little bit later and everything's gone. His paper has disappeared. There's no timeline. The saved file that had his paper in it is gone. All of his notes are gone. And it begins this liminal horror where he realizes that he's trapped in the library. He can't leave. But it's not the library as it was. It is now this kind of nightmare space and it's full nightmare logic. It jumps around a little bit. He doesn't just stay in the library. He definitely kind of moves through the library space, but it made me think about liminal horror can exist anywhere. Like as long as there is kind of this endless space that you can drift through. So he's drifting through stacks for a lot of it. And then he winds up in a copy room and the whole time really like fucked up nightmare logic-y shit is happening. And there's not really a lot of explanation on some of it. Some of it we do get a little bit, but it's just such a simplistic setup directed by Abby Seidel, who I had not heard of before, but is now definitely on my radar. So yeah, this was really fun for a liminal horror, which I will say I'm hit or miss on liminal horrors. Like I loved Outwaters because I felt like it was doing something really bigger picture. But this I found intriguing just because how well it was using the space and the logic. And you could tell this was like totally indie small production, but they were doing something cool with it. So Cram on Tubi.
All right. Well, speaking of liminal horror, one of the liminal horrors partially that we saw last year or the year before, We're All Going to the World's Fair,
Yep.
by Jane Schoenbrunn. They have made what is probably one of the most anticipated movies of this year and won major prize at Sundance, called I Saw the TV Glow, coming from A24 in, I think, 2 weeks from now. So I'm not going to go too deep on it because it's not out yet, and there might still be some embargoes. I don't know if they're, I think they kind of lift more or less now. But what I will say, this is definitely the most kind of fascinating movie I've seen so far this year. And by that, I mean it's not horror with a big H. It is definitely could be categorized with as horror in the same way Twin Peaks can be categorized in horror. Like Fire Walk With Me is pure horror, but Twin Peaks, the TV show, is like unsettling. This is very much a vibe film, but it has dread from start to end. Like there isn't even a beat that doesn't have a sense of dread. There is no happy moment in this thing. Basically, you're watching Justice Smith, who's a really great young actor. He's from Detective Pikachu, which is underrated. Go Detective Pikachu. But he is basically, well, he's the later version. It starts when a younger version of him, who's probably like in sixth grade or something like that, is very isolated. It does not fit in. This is very much a film about the horror of, like, not the horror isn't coming from some outside thing so much as it's coming from inside, where you don't feel you belong. The world feels off because you don't feel like you belong in it. And I thought it feels incredibly original, and that gets thrown around a lot, but I mean that in a way where it's like I can't put it into an easy category of what it's like from other movies. The only thing vibe wise that it's very much like is Channel Zero. It's like it feels like an entire season of Channel Zero in one movie, but it's more character focused, a little less of the heartbeat focused, and sadder, and kind of more haunting than that, because it does such a good job of evoking, I think it's set like in the 90s, evoking that time through a lens you haven't quite seen before, definitely through an outsider lens and outsider relationship. These are not the cool teens that you see, or even nerdy teens in 80s movies. These are the isolated, almost can't even communicate syllables because you're not used to people actually talking to you, so you just talk to yourself or mumble or think inside your head. That's what these characters are. And so at one point, his parent home life's kind of weird too, and at some point he meets this teenage girl who's a couple years older than him, from the same school, and she is telling him about a TV show she's obsessed by called The Pink Opaque, and he's not allowed to watch it because it starts at 10 p.m. His parents won't let him, and she's telling how amazing it is. And for her, she's identifying because she's actually a queer character and knows it, but other people can't really say that back then in this time period. And say she doesn't lead with it, but it's kind of clear. And this is a show about two young teen girls who are like on adventures and a weird, sinister force. And it's like cheesy graphics and cheesy. It's really fun because they're kind of taking off of the kind of TV shows in the 90s. And she says one day, "Well, why didn't you come over and watch it?" And so he has to sneak out of his house to go to her house to watch it. He has to make up a whole story like he's staying at a friend's house, and the parents think it's a little weird, and he becomes obsessed, and they become bonded through this show that at some point is going to be canceled, and it leads to a whole, almost like a them imagining an alternate reality that is based in that show. And I won't say more than that because it is very much about the vibes to get to this part of the story, but it's very much about these two people trying to relate, because they are both so outside the norm of their friend groups and the popularity groups of the school, that it opens up to some very interesting weird stuff. I'm still thinking about it. It's one of the few movies I've seen this year where I like, right now I'm not sure where it placed, but if I watch it again, it might go right to the top because it was so interesting. But I walked out with my head swirling, like, huh, what? Hard to place it. And I think for me, that can be an exciting thing. That's how I felt about Cronenberg movies when I was young. I didn't know exactly where to place it straight away. And I think it's because it's doing something that's just not, it's not a straight banger horror film. It's something else.
Well,
And
you're going to go back and see it again
I
in
think
a
I
couple of
would.
weeks with me.
Because also I went to a
So, yeah.
screening room, and the theater is a pretty small screen. I would like to see this on a really big screen. I think it would be, it's got also great music, a soundtrack. Jane got a soundtrack of, like, I think their favorite bands doing covers or something. And it felt very 90s and super cool. Super cool film. I think for the right people, this will be like that. Somebody's looking for exactly this movie this year, and I think they're gonna kind of have their minds blown. And goes to show, when we're just talking about risk in terms of marketing, I would say this is the thing about studios too. We're All Going to the World's Fair is not an obvious film to then give a much bigger platform to its director. Even though we dug it, it would make sense for somebody to give them maybe twice as much money. But this is a big A24 canvas, And that's a big, and it's pulled off. And so I think it just goes to show, if you give artists and people the belief, you know, and the freedom to do what they want to do, good stuff can get made. But it's a risk. Everything's a risk. You know, you can't make films without risk. And people try to go, oh, we don't want to take a risk, but we'll spend $500 on Marvel. It's still a risk. You can make a bad one and it can topple down. So,
yeah, we've been seeing that a lot lately,
yes,
but
a lot more lately.
Hollywood is a business. And at the end of the day, they don't like risk. So Everything's all about risk mitigation, even
but,
though that's
but
what
the reward comes from the risk. Like, and like the people forgetting already, but Barbie is the hugest risk. I mean, it's such a massive risk hiring Greta Gerwig for that. Massive. Mm-hmm. She is an indie darling, has nothing to do with mainstream filmmaking, and she knocks it out of the park and makes them $1 billion. That is exactly.
And she's not even nice about Barbie the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, it's very critical of Barbie.
The product is treated like totally. But that's what I'm saying. Like, that is like what risk can do. And that has always been the case in the film industry. That's why so many great movies are made in the 70s. It's just getting to the point where people are getting safer and safer, and things are getting too expensive. But.
Well, and plus we've had that massive kind of constriction within the industry lately, where it's hard to get stuff made. Like, we are not doing, I think that the estimate that I saw on Deadline was that 20% less stuff is being made right now than usually is. And it was like mostly in the television sphere, but movies as well. Like, nobody is very confident in
there's a lot of fear about more strikes and stuff that people
and
are
I'm
speaking on, which
sure.
sucks.
I'm sure it will eventually kind of, the pendulum will swing back the other way. It's not the first time that we've seen this type of restriction within the industry. But that said, it sucks to kind of be in right now because it isn't a big risk-taking Hollywood moment by any stretch.
Well, I will say all the films I've liked this year from this and Love Lies Bleeding, they've all been made as like movies I would say is, wow, that was a big swing, a risky endeavor. Mm-hmm. So I saw the TV Glow, which I definitely think there's a whole generation, our generation for sure, of people who weren't necessarily raised by the TV, but spent more time in the glow of the TV than they did their parents' instruction.
It's supposed to be like a Buffy rip, right?
It's just one of the things that the director probably was into, but you wouldn't feel that from it. It hasn't got that pacing or anything. Definitely the closest would be the pacing of and vibe of a Channel Zero, especially the first season.
Nice.
That the way it just kind of unfolds without really peaks and valleys, almost like one tonal movement, which I'm trying to say is not a negative thing. It's more of a different kind of filmmaking. I thought it was really cool. So look out for that coming out very soon. I saw the TV Glow.
Okay, I'm going to talk about one more movie and then I've got a couple of books to touch on. And this one was kind of a thing that I was not expecting to watch or like. This is a horror film on Netflix that's been there for a couple of months now. It was new probably back in January, so I'm a little bit late to it, but called Re/Member.
I think I've seen the word, but don't know what it is.
Yeah, and it is Japanese. And it is about a group of students in high school, and we go through their first day. Like, and it's shitty. They all hate each other. There's the popular kids. There's this girl who's really heavily picked on. And throughout the day, you're getting rumors that there was once a murder that happened at school. It's spreading kind of like an urban legend. And that night, they're all like picking on each other, and you really see kind of the course of events as they play out. That night, this group of kids who all kind of get involved in this thing that happens at school that day, it's kind of breakfast clubby, how they all kind of end up getting punished for this thing. They all go home that night, hating each other, and they all dream that they are back in the school together and that there is this ghost that is hunting them, trying to kill them. And if it kills them in the dream, they disappear. And they wake up. And then they realize that they're repeating the same day as the day before, but they can remember it. And they remember their dream. They remember that they were in each other's dream that night. And what they realize is that they are being haunted by this ghost. And it's the girl who was killed really close to the school. She was completely dismembered. And they have to find all of her body parts, which have been spread out all over the school, and put her corpse back together in order to stop the days from repeating. But every night they're dying and it's getting more violent at school. But because they are going through this thing together every night in their dreams, they're living that day that they're living over and over differently, because now they're all friends and they're spending their days eating lunch together, trying to figure out their strategy for finding all the body parts that night. This, it felt like Groundhog Day with a really wild supernatural twist that I was not expecting. And I won't call it too close to Groundhog Day because the point of it, where it spends the bulk of its time, is not necessarily in the repeating days. It's in those nights that they're all together trying to escape the ghost while also trying to find all of her parts. So it's got a lot going on. It's not perfect plot-wise, but I enjoyed this way more than I thought I would had somebody just told me that log line. I would have been like, yeah, I've seen a horror Groundhog Day before. I'm good. But there was really something interesting happening in this that I really enjoyed and had not expected to. So this one is on Netflix right now called Re/Member. It's from 2022, but again, I think it's only been on Netflix for a couple of
Where'd
months.
you say it was from? South Korea or no,
Netflix.
it's
Oh,
Japan.
it's I think it's
Okay.
Japanese. Hold on. Let me double check that. Where are you from? I can't even find that now. Talk, go ahead and I will double check that.
Okay. It's always a curveball.
Yes.
The last one I saw was a very last minute one. It must have just gotten added last night. And I'd heard that David Cronenberg's daughter was going to make her first film. I know she's a visual artist. I've followed her on Instagram before.
I'll quickly
Yeah.
interrupt. It is the director from Assassination Classroom, which I didn't even connect. This is the guy who directed Assassination Classroom did this. I still haven't figured out where it's from.
Oh,
I just thought that was
I have no
cool.
idea what that is. Assassination.
It is Japan.
Oh,
It is
okay.
Japan.
Anyway, yeah, so David Cronenberg's daughter, Caitlin Cronenberg, I had read that she had made a movie but kind of forgot about it and was curious because obviously, his son has been making some real bangers over there. And I was very curious about this one. It's called Humane. It popped up la late last night and I was like, oh shit, we're about to do the show. Let me check out this new movie. And I was so pleasantly surprised by this, but it won't be for everyone. It is a more like a really dark black comedy. It reminded me more of a mixture of The Menu and Cheap Thrills. And so if that sense of humor, because I find The Menu to be,
That's an odd
well, I think The Menu
combination
is
of
funny. I think
prompts.
The Menu is a funny movie. It's really dark, and Cheap Thrills is very, very funny. But The Menu, it looks a bit like The Menu, this film for one, and it has that same contained setting movie. So basically, in the first 5 minutes, I was like, oh, I'm not going to like this because it's like in the wake of environmental collapse. This is like in the near future. There's been massive, the environment's gone to shit. It's not super in the future, just recent future. We now are at a point where we have to shed the population by 20%. And each country is given mandates that they have to hit. And the first way they try to get people to do it so they don't have to murder everyone, like the Purge are saying, is to basically volunteer. You do these volunteers and people like to do it to inspire others because you're going to help the planet in the future. And we meet at the very start of this. So I was like, okay, big high concept. Is this going to be, I'm not sure if I'm up for this. And then we meet the family and it's Peter Gallagher, who we've all seen lots of Soderbergh movies and other, just a great actor. He's the head of this family, very rich man, was a TV journalist who's retired. Him and his wife, who's his, like, not the mother of his children, but his current wife, they're hosting a dinner party. That's why I say it's like The Menu. They're going to bring all his kids there and tell them something. And they all come to his house. And Jay Baruchel, the very funny Canadian, this is a Canadian film, obviously, actor, is kind of an outspoken TV personality, the kind of guy going, look, would I let my own 10-year-old? Sure, I'd let my 10-year-old volunteer. I mean, that's his choice. Like, and everyone's like, wait, that's controversial. Young people shouldn't have to die and blah, blah. And so his dad's kind of like, oh, you're so full of shit. He's come home for the dinner. One of his daughters is a failing actress who is just a hot mess. And one of them is a very controversial big business woman who's currently being investigated for some sort of fraud. And then they have an adopted son who has been in AA and had all sorts of rehab issues, who's finally started to get their life on track. So these four people are coming home. They start to have this dinner, and I'm this won't ruin where it goes, but it will give it a nice hook. The parents basically say, "We brought you here because we've decided we're going to volunteer for death." And they're like, "What? Rich people don't do this. This is for poor people. Everyone knows. Like, you can get out of it. I'll just get you out of it." And he's like, "No, I've decided I want to. I want to. I've lived my life as a good person. I want to do this." And then they're like, "No, you're not going to do this." And then the door goes ding dong, and the service shows up to your house to like, "Yeah, we're here to kill a couple people." And it's this guy, it gives one of my favorite performances of the year, but it's like very comedic. Like the movie isn't pure comedy. It's like quite dark and kind of horror-y thriller at times. But his name's Enrico Colatoni. I wouldn't have recognized the name, but he plays Laura Mars's dad in the TV show Laura Mars.
Wait, I know that
He's like
name.
a
And
bald guy,
Repo?
round. He's just a really fun-looking character actor, and he.
I know him from Galaxy Quest.
Okay.
He plays the head Martian on
Which is
Galaxy
great. He
Quest.
is.
And he was on Just Shoot Me. He played the photographer on Just
Yeah,
Shoot
Just Shoot
Me.
Me. Yeah, but Laura Mars was obviously on for a very long time, and he was a very fun dad character. He is fucking like I just found his character is so funny. He basically goes, "Look, yeah, we come here, we do the service, no problem, we knock it out." And then Peter Gallagher's like, "I'm kind of having second thoughts. His wife isn't hanging around, so he's like trying to get out of it." And he's like, "Well, let me talk to you in another room." And basically, they present you with paperwork that will ruin your life if they present it to the world if you don't go through with the process. So you're kind of fucked. And so when they get there, he decides we're going to do it, but your wife's not here, which means I need another body. I said I came here for two bodies, so you guys have 2 hours to figure out who the other body is going to be. And that, so I'll only go that far. And chaos, this is what I mean by a bit of a cheap thrills vibe, is chaos as these characters are trying to figure out who deserves to live, who should die, why are we in this kind of absurdist nightmare future. And I really like, I do think it's going to be one of those things where if the comedy connects, you're going to really like this film. And I like dark humor, that I like really dark humor to the point where it's almost not funny. And I found this to be really refreshing, and there's action in it. It gets pretty crazy. Yeah, I thought it was real cool. It ended and I was like, damn, all these Cronenbergs can make movies, you know, all three of them. And it's cool that this is different enough from the other. It still has a sci-fi trapping, but it's definitely more like The Menu in its kind of world and execution. I think you, as I was watching, I think you would dig it. I don't think, you know,
Okay.
I'd be curious to see but you, I think, would laugh and enjoy it. And it's just a fun concept. Like, oh, he needs a body because that's what his service does, and you promised him, and that's what he's here for. And it's just, you know, quite a bleak idea to save the future.
I just added this on Amazon while we were talking.
Yes,
$6.99 to
it's a new
rent. I
release, so it's.
might end up watching it
I
tonight.
assume, I think it's probably in indie cinemas too. So I think that's why I was excited. I was like, oh, cool. I don't have to go to the cinema for this one just because I was wanting to see it. So Humaine, director Caitlin, it did have the Shudder thing pop up at one point. So maybe it will eventually be on Shudder, but I get the feeling it might be a while for one of those. So yeah, fun last second watch.
Nice. Okay. Let me dive into some books, which I will get through pretty quickly. I'm gonna start with Drowning House. This is not hitting till July, so I won't say much about it yet because you've got a couple months, but add it to your upcoming book list, your summer reading list. This is The Drowning House by Sherry Priest. This was a really cool concept, and it was the concept, the hook. Like, I usually will pick up horror books because I hear they're good. This one, I was sent the log line and I was like, okay, I'm in for this. It is a small town where a group of kids grew up and they're now adults. And they go back home because somebody who was like their caretaker when they were kids had died this like pretty violent death on a beach. And she died of fright, but there was nothing there and they don't know what she died of. So these three kids have kind of gone, well, one lives there, two of the others have gone back to this island for her funeral and to help out the one who's been there taking care of her during her final days. And they get there, and this is all happening on like this waterfront island, and a house literally washes up on the beach, an entire house. And they start going through it and exploring it, and they're immediately like getting bad feelings about it. And what the hell is this? And that's as far as I'm going to go with it because that is like a hell of a hook to begin with, that an entire house has just washed up on the beach. And I found this, it was took a little bit of time to get going, but as soon as the house appears, it was like flying. And so yeah, this one is coming in July, The Drowning House. Okay, next one I watched is a red. Sorry, a lot going on this week. The next one that I read was Bruises on a Butterfly, which I don't have the copy of in front of me to show because I gave it to Dick Gruner because it was good and I wanted to pass it on. This is from, I believe, Cemetery Dance Publication, written by Chad Lutzi. And I love this one. It's a novella, Bruises on a Butterfly, but it is short, highly cosmic. It is about a group of boys, basically starts out as like a kids on bikes. It's a group of kids, very much into like horror films. And they have a fort in the field near their house where they all get together. One of the boys is being abused and decides that he's basically going to live at the fort because he doesn't want to go home. So like he wants his dad to think he ran away. And he is basically living at the fort and his friends are bringing him stuff. Until one night that a comet falls or meteor and hits near the field and he touches something in it. And then it goes full cosmic body horror as he begins changing, I'll say. This one, it was short. I read this entire thing in 2 days, and I just loved the cosmic nature of it, how it does go full cosmic horror with kind of the changes and his own metamorphosis and how it relates back to the trauma that he already had. So that one, smaller press, but super tight, Bruises on a Butterfly. And then the one that really fucked me up, which I just asked our guest, Paul Tremblay, about off air, and he was like, oh yeah, that's a pretty heavy one. Last Days by Brian Evanson. This I had read about, I want to say that like 101 books to read before you're murdered. I want to say it talked about this one and said how disturbing and fucked up it was. And I'm pretty sure that that was my hook, is I was like, well, if it's disturbing and fucked up, I'm totally in. And then I forgot that it had said that until I picked this up from my library. And then I read it, not remembering why I had put it on my library queue. And then I was like, oh my God, this is so disturbing and fucked up. And it completely like sideswiped me. So this is about a cop, or I guess he's more of a detective, who was hunting a criminal, a killer, and in his final showdown with the killer, he loses his arm. His arm gets cut off. And he is recovering from it. He ends up killing the killer in the process, but he is now missing part of his arm. He's missing his hand. And he is now on his recovery from it, but he's basically suffering from PTSD. Like, he's having problems functioning. He's having problems getting out of the bed. He just doesn't want to do anything. He doesn't want to go back to work because he's just depressed about where he is now and what happened to him. When out of nowhere, these two other guys, both missing limbs, show up in suits and say, we know you're a detective. We belong to an organization. We have had a murder within our organization. We need you, because you have special skills, to come solve the murder that happened in our organization. And they basically don't give him a choice. They like take him hostage, kidnap him, throw him in a car, and drive him. And where he arrives is in a cult, a society of people who believe the more body parts you can amputate, the closer you are to God. And so, and they rank themselves by numbers. Like, I'm a one, I cut off my hand. I'm a 10, you know, all of my fingers, you know, I took an eyeball out and one of my butt cheeks. And so they rank themselves by that. And the more things you can remove off your body, the closer you are to God. And within this very weird, secret, fucked up cult, there has been a murder that he is now being tasked to sign. This was brutal. I had no idea where this was going. And the setup was so fucking weird to begin with. And it was just, I could not put this down. And I was horrified and really wanted to at times. So Brian Evanson, Last Days, this has been out for a long time. It's probably like 10 years old, if not more. But yeah, I know you had read a bunch of other
Brian Evanson. I read only the shorts. A friend of mine in New Zealand had recommended him, and also it said he lived near me. So I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I read something called Wind Eye, and it was just like short stories only. So I'm curious how, because the short stories were pretty dense. So I'm curious how it would translate to a full length book.
So this started, and this contains both. This started as like a 30, 40 page novella. And so the novella, the short story that it's based on, is in here. But then the second part is the full novel. And so I didn't read the short story. I just jumped straight into the full novel, which is completely fucked up. So yes, for those people who are really looking something to kind of melt your brain for a weekend, Last Days, Brian Evanson.
I won't go deep, but I read, you can follow on Goodreads, the ones, but right before I read Paul's book, I had to quickly finish because it really was one of the most fun, easy reads I've had this year. And it's called Daphne. And it relates to a conversation we had with a previous guest about there not being enough basketball horror. And remember that conversation?
That was Stephen Graham Jones. Stephen, yeah. Y'all made me watch
Night of the Dribbler, which I still haven't seen.
Night of the Dribbler. I gave you a copy of that, right?
No, I don't think so. I've been waiting to see it.
Oh, I have, because I bought the real copy when we were at the video store in Knoxville.
That's right, yeah.
And so I have a bootleg of it that I will gladly pass to you so you can experience Night of the Dribbler.
So I was happy to see that Josh Malerman, who obviously had a huge hit with Bird Box, had this novel that had a really cool cover. It was on my birthday, actually. I walked into the bookstore. I like to do just something random like that and buy a couple novels that I don't know if they're going to be good or not. And it had a cool cover. And I was like, okay, interesting. And it's a girls' basketball team. It opens with them winning like the kind of the final shot. And it's got a really interesting thing where the girl, she asks questions of the rims about her life. Like, and if it goes in, it means one thing. If it misses, and that's how they kind of live their life. And instantly, I was kind of into this. And then basically what it becomes about is there is some local legend in this town that everyone has, seems to have forgotten about, that once you start thinking about it, you can't stop thinking, and it's going to come and kill you. And it's a 7-foot girl wearing all heavy metal patches who didn't play basketball and was kind of the town reject, who was killed in the past for this weird reason by a girls' basketball team. And it's all stuff that might sound silly, but like the way he kind of builds up this like very mysterious tension, and then one by one they are just being rudely crushed, like their heads are being crushed, of these girls and this basketball team, because they can't stop thinking of the name Daphne. And no one knows, and it all starts because a girl had to sleep over the night before tells them the story of Daphne, and now they can't stop thinking about it. It was really
ludicrous,
cool.
Yeah. But wild.
Yeah, it was really cool, and it was a really easy read. It was just one of those reads where I was like, huh, this is one of the more fun things I've actually read this this year so far, and I had to finish it before reading something else, because it was just, I could visualize the killer really well. It was just a cool, and it doesn't explain every little thing, which I appreciated. And again, I wasn't that aware of him as a writer outside of the fact that he had written a very, you know, bestseller that turned into a movie. But yeah, so now somebody has to make Daphne so I can watch a basketball supernatural movie. We need more.
Excellent. Okay, well, speaking of books, perfect segue. Let's dig in with our guest, renowned horror author Paul Tremblay. Okay, y'all, we are welcome to bring on amazing writer, horror extraordinaire. He's been on some of our prior shows, but we're happy to have him back with us. Welcome to the show, Paul Tremblay. How are you doing?
Thanks. I'm doing well. Thanks. Yeah, it's glad to be back. It's great to see you guys. I mean, on Zoom, but you know.
I know. It works.
It does work.
It has opened up our worlds, because previously we were always looking for, okay, who's in LA at any given time so we could get them in person. And now we're like, we can just interview them anywhere. So it's opened up our guest options.
And people always criticize us for stepping on each other. They're always like, oh, you interrupt each other. I'm like, you try talking on Zoom.
We interrupted each other when we were in person. It doesn't matter. We've been doing this for years. Yeah. Like, we talk over top of each other is what we do. But Paul, you have a new book coming out. We are so excited to talk about. Elric just finished it this morning. Like, ooh. I think I got to be honest. I think he missed work to finish your book.
I was late.
He texted me. Yeah, he was late. He texted me on the way and he was like, I had to stay home and finish Paul's book. So tell us about horror movie.
Yeah. So horror movie, I'm so bad at like to tell us, but I'll ramble. But so anyway, the gist of it is it's centered around like sort of a cursed film. You know, in 1993, these 20 somethings made a disturbing, pretentious art house horror movie, which is sort of my favorite kind. but it didn't go all the way to screen, you know, because something happened on set. And the story is being told by a man who played this character called the Thin Kid. You never get his name. He was just referred to as the Thin Kid, as he is in the film. So not a huge spoiler, but the book is actually sort of his audiobook talking about, you know, what had happened on set in 1993 and what's happening now as they're trying to reboot it. And also intercut with his sort of narration of sort of the secrets of what had happened on and off set, is you get pretty much the entire screenplay of the movie, which is just called Horror Movie. And then like weird, disturbing things happen.
it was an incomplete movie, which is the cool thing. Like it's an abandoned movie more or less, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they almost shot everything, but like all people saw, like in 2008, someone associated with the film, well, I'll just say that, released like 3 scenes onto YouTube, some still images and the whole screenplay. So then this movie, in the years after, got like this weird, almost like Jodorowsky, if I'm saying his name right, Dune-esque, sort of like, oh, this film that never was, is famous for being never was kind of thing.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to we definitely will talk not on spoilers, because
not on that.
It, as much as you've given, that's enough of a hook. It was nice to go in like blind, and like I was telling you, like you have to acclimatize a little bit, because it's the kind of book where I was slower reading it at the start, and then once I was locked in, I kind of raced through it because I was so in the world of this narrator who is, you know, a really likable narrating character, but the things he's going into and the worlds he's kind of bringing you back to are pretty, it would be like if you're following the Blair Witch Project's making of, if that film had never seen the screens it saw, you know, and it had this kind of thing about, but there's some really interesting themes, I think, especially like the teen I wouldn't say like teen depression, but there's something about some of these characters that the why they're making this in the first place that is always very mysterious from start to end, which I really appreciate that mystery, but also with the kind of darker side of being young.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. I mean, that's definitely there. I mean, you know, I would preface like, you know, if we talk like the high-minded stuff, you know, if I can call it high-minded, I mean, hopefully I do find the book is thrilling and scary and disturbing as hell, hopefully. But yeah, I mean, it's about sort of like the sacrifices you might make for art, you know, however you want to describe art. And for me as a novelist, it was fun to sort of explore the more collaborative aspect of filmmaking, which I generally don't have. It was funny before we all started, you know, Rebecca and I were briefly talking about like, you know, when you're publishing a book, like I have an editor and that's, you know, I'll have first readers too, but like, I'm not getting notes from X amount of producers or the director or this stuff here. So for me, it was fun to imagine that collaborative aspect that I really haven't experienced very much. You know, so I did lean on some filmmaking friends when I was writing the book. You know, I had asked questions and talked to Natasha Kermani and Bria Grant. You know, people live in LA, and I'm sure you probably met them. Yeah. Also, Alejandro Bruguez. You know, I leaned on him quite a bit, and also, why am I spacing on his name? Oh my God, I'm so sorry. My brain's not working. It's not British director Simon last name. What?
Oh, Adam Simon? No, he's not British. Ulrich, help.
I can help you out because you have the acknowledgments. So David Slade?
David Slade.
Oh, that's
Slade.
It.
Jesus Christ.
It's not even close to Simon.
One of those like 50-year-old moments where it's like, oh, I know this person. I'm friends with him. I've been to his house. I've had dinner with him, and I'm not remembering his name.
He did Dark Harvest last year, which we enjoyed. So, yeah. So with that, I loved how it intelligentized, that's not a word, but I'm going to use it. It brought in kind of the heady cerebral quality that goes with like low budget indie filmmaking. And I love that you combine the two together in that capacity. It reminded me of something that Elric and I have talked about on the show before, Demon Lover Diary, which is all about kind of the psychological side of making a really low budget indie horror film. And I loved how it kind of combined this really heavy psychological stuff with something that is usually considered to be kind of sophomoric in practice. So it was beautiful how it kind of combined the two. But my question is, half of this book is a screenplay, which means you've now dabbled in screenplay writing. I mean, this is what we were talking about before the show. So like, how was it kind of, you know, it's vastly different from writing a novel. How was it kind of bringing in that screenplay as a medium to use in this? And, you know, what were the differences?
Yes, he took some liberties. Some screenwriting teachers are going to get him with asterisks being like, you're not meant to mention this person's psychological. Yeah. No, I loved it. That made it more fun to read, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, that's not a spoiler at all, but like a character who wrote the screenplay very like within the first 30 pages of the novel says, oh, I know, like I'm breaking screenplay rules with this, but it's purposeful. You know, so, you know, to bend to sort of the book's needs. But geez, when did I start writing this book? I started writing it, I think, the spring of 21 ish. Is that true? No. 22. Sorry. Spring of 22. And when The Cabin at the End of the World was going to be a movie, like, you know, I knew that was, well, I didn't know for sure until the spring of 21, I guess. No, spring of 22. My dates are all messed up. Anyway, so right around the same time, like the idea of this book hit as I was starting to go through the adaptation experience with Knock at the Cabin / Cabin at the End of the World. So around that, I mean, I had been thinking for a few years, geez, you know, I would like to maybe try my hand at adapting some of my things, you know, having a little bit more say in what, you know, goes on. You know, even though, I mean, that's the only movie. I don't want to say only as like I expect more. Like I'll be very lucky if I get another one, but you know, if there's another chance, I would like to have a little bit more say in things or a little bit more creative. Yeah. Well, we'll see. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying I've tried dabbling in some screenplays, nothing too crazy. Like I've taken a couple of short stories and tried, you know, expanding them. But yeah, the screenplay part of horror movie was a lot of fun because I could just like, I allowed myself to break all the rules. Like, you know, you probably would not turn in a screenplay as is written in that book. Although I would pay money to have some of those scenes made.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also it's a different kind of film, right? Like it's a personal, what I like about it is they aren't just making another indie horror film. They're making a personal indie film. So it's not just that it's art house, it's
Right.
that there's this personal, not literal personal, but not autobiographical exactly, but they're putting their emotions and they're not explaining a lot of the things, and a lot of the beats remain mysterious to certain people in the film, which makes it just very intriguing. I wondered if was it because, you know, you're talking about Kevin, but you also had other books that were being optioned or developed. Did that process trigger the idea, like being in development from places trigger the idea for this, or was this coming from just your love of horror movies and curiosity?
I mean so like the Hollywood experience is definitely, you know, satirized at times in the book. So I mean that was there, but the trigger to the book, you know, the fun sort of like thing that sparked the what if, and then I think all that other stuff informed it, was watching Walter Chow and John Darnielle discuss Texas Chainsaw Massacre on YouTube, because Walter during the pandemic was hosting like Saturday matinees with the Denver Public Library. And Walter is, you know, an amazing film critic and writer for those listening. You know, you should definitely check out his reviews. It's was it Film Threat?
Mm-hmm.
No, I think it's Film Threat.
Yeah.
Again, don't worry. You can Google. So I watched, it was such a fun discussion. And during the discussion, Walter held up Chainsaw Confidential, the book that Gunnar Hansen had written about his experiences on set. And at the, you know, at the time, like I didn't spring for a physical copy because they're really expensive, that it's out of print, but it's on Audible, really cheap. So I listened to it and it was just so much fun. It was so well written. I had no idea that, you know, Gunnar was a poet before, you know, he did the movie. So, you know, a lot of the book, he was talking about how dangerous parts of the filming was, you know, including some, you know, many of the famous scenes. So the initial what if was like, oh, you know, sort of the nightmare, I guess, Yvonne says, like, what if there was a terrible accident on set, or what if something went wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the original what if that's, you know, spun off into, you know, into what horror movie was.
Well, the difference of like, and people always, I mean, I always use this way to describe Texas Chainsaw, I always call it like, it feels dangerous, and and not many, there are very few I'd put in that category. But yes, if something had gone wrong on that exact film, we might never have seen it, never have discussed it. Instead, it changed cinema, and yours is kind of about that. It, without, and we won't get into any deeper because I think it's nice it's nice to discover it. I don't think all books are tough, but I think this one, if you know too much, you'll be ahead of it, and you don't want to be ahead of it.
I think so too. Yeah, I mean the amazing thing about, you know, Chainsaw, like, so they made this amazing piece of art. It's a brilliant film, and it's still, you know, as effective now as it was, I'll assume, as it was then. But like, but yeah, I mean, they took chances. I mean, they weren't, I don't think Toby Hooper was being a good person while making that movie necessarily, but, you know, what's the price of art? I mean, I think that's some of what maybe the book asks a little bit, is like, how far do you go? You know, is it worth it? And the thrill, I mean, the thrill of sort of that like transgression or that sort of barter with art, like, you know, how much are you going to put into it? Like, how much are you going to expose of somebody else? And, you know, without, you know, the danger of like a chainsaw actually cutting somebody.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in Texas Chainsaw.
Well, certain psychosis takes over for directors, especially very indie, because to pull it off, it's almost impossible, right? So there's no apparatus to save you. There's no money in the back pocket. So everything is online. So I think there's something to that that creates something that is probably a touch dangerous if things go wrong.
Yeah, no, and I find that just utterly fascinating.
Especially being on set, like there's moments on set where you don't realize that something is unsafe until you kind of step back and look at it hours later and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe, like even just looking at some of like my early short films or like things that, you know, other people that sets that I worked on in college where I was like, I can't believe we fucking did that. How are we alive now? And I mean, that was a different time. I think my students, at least I hope my students are safer now. We try to teach them to be safer now. But still, when you're on set and you're trying to create it, the idea of kind of pushing it, it feels natural. And I think that we're at a different time now where we're really trying to be conscious of it. But
as we should.
Yeah.
What about
Oh, go
Oh,
ahead,
I was just
Alex.
going to ask also, and I don't know if you view it this way, but I also like that it's kind of also like reading an emerging urban legend, or it feels like the birth of a new story. And without getting too deeply, what's your interest in that? Like, also reminded me of things like, Channel Zero, the show, like elements of things that are
I felt
about,
creepypastas.
yeah, but in a way that
Yeah.
it feels like it's
Yeah.
a fresh spin. But how much of that stuff were you, have you been interested in the last year? Is that something that keeps you up at night?
Well, I mean the show Channel Zero itself, but like maybe I don't go into the creepypastas too much because I worry as a horror writer that I might take a little bit too much from it. But I think it was more like, so even though I'm a novelist and like I've done zero screenwriting, my first, like many people, my first exposure to story was film. Like I didn't even become a reader for pleasure until I was like 21, 22. I was very late in coming to reading. Like for me, it was, cable television came to my town like absurdly early. I think we got it like 1980 or something like that.
Oh, wow. We were still fighting for it in like the mid
Yeah.
90s. That's
So like
awesome.
I, sort of a lonely kid, with younger siblings, but I'd just come home and watch cable TV and I'd see the same movies over and over again. So to me, up and through until like those very, that formative age, 20 and 21. And then I discovered, the love of reading. To me, it was like, oh, I had to like reading. To me, it was like, oh, here's another way to tell story, like as opposed to film. So, in this book, it was kind of fun to sort of, I guess, roll around in the sort of, hopefully, the filmic language. Because I've been told as a writer, and I don't know if this is always a compliment. It's like, oh, your stuff is so cinematic. And sometimes I think that's like a backhanded compliment because books that aren't necessary, aren't. I don't think books should be books and not, movies or treatments,
Well,
et
I think
cetera.
people would say the same about King, though, and so that's not a bad thing. I think it just means we can see it.
No, I
We can
could.
see it, and you can, whereas some books are more, there's some people who, like even Barker, who I love Clive Barker, I find some of that harder. When I see his movies, I get them as movies, but his books, I don't always see everything. It's
Yeah, I
difficult, I
remember reading Imagicaa, and like there's points where it visually loses me. Or like
know.
Lovecraft, there's moments where I'm like, I can't even picture this. But I feel like that's what that means, is like it plays like a movie in your head the whole time.
So, I mean,
But
for as often as I would say the last thing is for as often as I've been told by producers and other people, like, oh, the book is, it's not the same as the movie. We have to do different things. It works vice versa as well. Like, I always tell young writers, like, you should write this as like, this is the best and only way to tell this story. Like, if you're going to be lucky enough that someone's going to adapt it, let them figure out how they're going to do it. Like, what you're doing, it should be told. It has to be told in this way. So, for one of the fun parts for me for this book was I felt like I got to cheat a little bit and maybe straddle both sort of worlds, hopefully.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, it reads like a it read it. Well, it's meant to be like a movie though, because it's an investigation of a movie and a character. Did you talk to any outside of the Gunnar Hansen? Did you talk to any men in suit or kind of that type of figures from cinema?
No. I mean, I think maybe the closest is my friend Stephen Graham Jones, because I think he's secretly a non-murdering slasher most of the time
He
anyway.
definitely knows most about slashers of anyone I
I
think I
was
know.
Yeah, I know. He is like some deep cut slashers. We've had
Oh
him
yeah.
on a number of times, and every single time I walk away with a list of films I haven't seen. So yeah,
Yeah, I'm
he's.
reading an early copy of his I Was a Teenage Slasher right
Oh,
now
cool.
as we speak. Well, not right
Yeah.
now as we're talking, but I was before I caught on.
Oh.
So I didn't talk to many more actors. I mean, I Brea Grant obviously has acted quite a bit. She does everything. So,
Yeah. Oh, I guess I meant like not just actors, because it's very
Sure.
specifically
Yeah,
about.
like someone who might wear a mask or
Yeah, which
something.
isn't always acting. I mean, that it's there's a form of acting required, but the person isn't always an actor, which is the case. And I found that to be a very interesting way to base a character on, basically.
Wait, Elric, weren't you
I've
a
been in
man
Lizard Man
in a
suit. Yes,
monster suit? You were a lizard
I've been
man.
Lizard Man in a film, yes, but I don't think there was any psychology to it whatsoever. It was just, please hold the playmate in your arms for photos and try to drown her. It was pretty routine, but I'm far less scarred than the character in your book.
Yeah. Well, my son once had to dress as a giant pizza slice for a baseball
For
game.
wow.
For New England listeners, Papagino's is
Oh
a
yeah.
New England chain of pizza. My wife sort of does marketing there. And Cole, as a summer job, was dressed as a giant slice of pizza. And I thought that was like the greatest summer job ever, and he hated it. He's like, oh, it's so heavy and it smelled. And
funny.
We used to have a radio station in my hometown, and their symbol was the duck. It was like this rubber duck, and I was the rubber duck in one of our town parades one year, and it was the smelliest, grossest summer of my life. Like, it was disgusting. I get it. But I want to ask, kind of, now that you've been through the process of taking a book and seeing it kind of all the way to a feature film, like, what was that adaptation process like for you? Was it awesome to see it transformed into something more visual, or was it kind of like a, you know, biting your tongue the whole way, or, you know, what was the process like?
I mean, every emotion possible. I mean, because it was, like, you know, life-changing and, you know, and really cool and amazing. You know, I think my favorite parts were getting to visit the set for 2 days. I mean, that was wonderful. And everyone was super approachable and friendly, and the actors were great. You know, and M. Night was, you know, very welcoming. I basically sat in a room, almost in a room in this built cabin for like a day and a half, and, you know, watched him work. And that was really, you know, it was fun just to see the collaboration. And it was a really, like, eye opening, like, oh, this is like $25 million. You can see all this stuff here. It maybe made me understand a little bit more, like, why studios make decisions that they do based on money, because that's a lot of freaking money.
No one realized how quickly the $25 million goes until you're sitting on set and you see hundreds of people running around for like months at a time, and then you're like, oh, well, that it goes quickly.
Yeah, but, you know, but at the, you know, at the same, you know, in the premiere was amazing. You know, at the same time, like, the frustrating parts were sort of the less, like, the changes in the movie, like, that I had plenty of time to, like, adapt to. You know, the, you know, Knight in a conversation, and which I really appreciated, was like, you know, told me what, you know, the major changes were going to be. I was just, it was more frustrating the lack of mention of the book in the marketing 6 months up to the movie, which still doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't need to go into too many details, but yeah, there was just some very head scratching, which seemed like, you know, Hollywood things.
Like an auteurist, and that not a slight on M. Night, but obviously M. Night is a person famous for writing and directing his material. So with some directors, that might not have been the case. It might be partially just because they're, you know, there's a brand, right?
Yeah, but, you know, you see it happen elsewhere. Like, was that movie with Christian Bale, The Pale Blue Eye? Is that the name of it?
Yeah.
Where was that the Poe? Yeah.
Like, that dude who wrote that book, like, he doesn't even get a credit until like the end of the movie.
Wow.
Which
I didn't, like, even know that, I mean, was based on a book.
Right.
Yeah.
That's just so obnoxious. So, like, when I was in the process, I heard from so many other writers, you know, the thing with being a novelist is we don't have a union. We have no protection.
Interesting.
Other than, like, whatever reps that you have. So our only protection is we talk to each other, and maybe we take our revenge in books.
Well, I guess the first one, there's a good chance of being taken advantage that first time, and there's a very low chance, hopefully, the second time. So you'd hope that, you know, with things like how to credit the book, you'd build that
but
in.
But even, like, like that part of it. I mean, I got like this big, fat, like, huge letter credit at the start of the movie. So, I mean, I was very happy about that. But you'd be surprised. I've heard from some folks, some giant, giant writers, in the things that studios and other people have tried to get over on them is really unbelievable.
Does that, you know, you talked about it a little bit, but, like, does that make you start? Have you had any inklings towards an original screenplay, like, just to from scratch? Because sometimes that is easier than adapting something that might be dense in a different direction.
I haven't thought too seriously about it just because I've been so busy. Like, most of the time I'm teaching, you know, in writing, and I still want to be a novelist first. So, like, all those things have priorities. You know, currently I am, like, I've been working with Natasha and Brea on a pitch for one of my short stories. So we haven't written the screenplay, but we have written like a 20-minute sort of treatment/pitch. And I'm working with another producer on another short story adaptation. I did actually get to write some of that screenplay. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Is the pressure change on you, like, personally, once the book, like, I remember when we first met and reading a great book, but then I remember being in airports, and same with John Darnielle, like I know John Darnielle as the Mountain Goats, and suddenly I was seeing his book, The Devil House, like, in everywhere at bookstores, and I'd see your book at airports, and to me that's often a quick sign of, like, okay, whatever they're trying to get you to grab at the, because King was always there, of course. Does that change just a kind of pressure of you know, of delivering, because obviously you also live a normal life, in quote marks, teaching and holding on to family life and things like that. How did that change for you?
Honestly, I haven't. The biggest change I felt in terms of the pressure was after I had Full of Ghosts. Was the self pressure? Was writing the next book that was really hard. Like, was one of the hardest things I've ever done, and most of it was because the book was so different from A Head Full of Ghosts. I wasn't as comfortable, and I was putting like so much pressure on myself. And I wrote my mentor, Stuart Anand, who's a brilliant writer. I sent him like this big whiny email. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. This is, you know, so much harder than the other book. Like, I don't know if it's as good. Like, expecting that he was going to write back and say, don't worry, Paul, you can do it. You're a good writer. And he just wrote back, eh, not everything you write is going to be great. And I started laughing, but that was exactly what I needed to hear.
I was going to say, there's a truth to that, that I feel like we have to embrace in filmmaking as well, that you just kind of have to embrace as an artist. But yeah.
Sure. So for me, it's always, I'm just going to try to make whatever it is, I'm going to try to make it the best it's going to be. And I really try to shut out any thoughts of audience because that stresses me out. Like, I just know who I am. Like, I can't read reviews. I can't have other opinions, like, because it gets to me. I mean, that's just a me problem, but I know how to handle it, or I know how to better handle it, I suppose. So, you know, the thing with the teaching part of it is like, oh, well, if no one likes this thing, I still have my crappy health insurance through this job. So I feel like it's allowed me to write things that I really, you know, want to write, these things that I sort of do consider like, you know, as art, whatever that means. You know, I really, you know, someday I would like to try writing full time. I think that day is getting closer.
Nice.
You know, maybe when my daughter graduates college, because college is very expensive. You know, so when that happens, you know, I'm not sure. Like, I think that's going to be hard. The 1 year I had off because of the movie, I did take a year off because of Knock at the Cabin, which was, you know, it was an amazing opportunity. I did find myself like really more, like my mental health was really like much more yo-yo-y. Because some of it was like, oh, I'm just in my head the whole time. And I don't know, you guys teach as well.
Yeah.
Even though like I complain about it all the time, it is also nice to worry about people outside of me, you know, worry about the students for a few hours, like as opposed to just being in my head the whole time.
Elric and I just talked about that this morning, that there is, because we are teachers, like there is, even if we had a ton of money and just health insurance was just given to us, we would still want to teach at least one class because we would miss it. And that's a weird thing to think about, that like, if I was to walk away tomorrow, I would miss teaching a class. Like,
but part of that might be that we teach the thing we love. You're teaching something, you're teaching like a, it would be like you're doing something very different part of the brain, right? Like,
I assume that you love math though. Like, it's, there's gotta be a reason.
I do like it. Love is strong. I sure love, I did miss it. But also, you know, it was nice to have that year. I got that book done, and I also wrote like a middle grade novel, which I wasn't expecting to write. I don't know, like, but teaching writing, like, to me, that stress, I've done it a few times, and that's been so much work for me because I'm not trained in teaching writing. Like, math, I can just sort of do, like, it doesn't change all that much. You know, calculus, they aren't really adding new calculus these days. So I don't know. I mean, as I'm getting older, I, you know, just in terms of energy level, it's getting harder to do both because the writing's getting busier and busier.
Yeah.
Does that become more of a summer thing for you? Like, is that when you have to crank through?
It can't. Okay. I mean, I have to do it during the year too. So, I mean, if it's during the school year, I try to squeeze in like an hour a day. Yeah. And, you know, on the weekends, maybe a little bit more. But also, like, I can't write for like, I wish I could write for 6 hours. Like, even like when I have my time off, like the most I can do is like two and a half. And then it's like, oh. You know, maybe then the afternoon I'll edit stuff. That was when I had time off. But
so yeah. I've asked Stephen Graham Jones and Grady Hendrix the same question, and I think we asked Daniel Krauss when he was on. I'm fascinated by the process of idea to execution. Specifically, I feel like most of us, you know, who are even remotely creative and kind of let the ideas flow, we have just a surplus. Like, they come constantly. Like, I'm brushing my teeth and I'm suddenly like, oh, killer toothbrush. Like, it's just a continuous flow of ideas, to the point of like writing. I know most writers, myself included, write the ideas down, like jotting them down in notebooks. How do you then decide, out of all of the weird brain leakings that you're collecting throughout the week, how do you say, this is the one, this is worth the next 6 months of my life to hammer this thing out? And are there points where you say, you know what, this isn't working, I'm going to shelve this and try something different?
Yeah,
So
six.
kind of how, like,
For me,
how
more
do
like
you,
12 months. Yeah.
12, it depends. Like, though I
Yeah.
just did the adolescent novel. That one
Sure.
flew a little bit more quickly. But yeah,
Yeah,
like
yeah.
how do you kind of determine what idea is going to be the one that you proceed with?
That's a great question. And I wish I had, like, I do keep a notebook and I write down, random ideas, but like I tend to be novel wise, I tend to be like novel to novel. Like I don't have like a bullpen of other ideas waiting for me. In fact, like, a horror movie was like a fun sort of, oh, like this thing appeared. I was half thinking of maybe doing something else, and I can't even remember what that was. So anyway, but how I know, especially if it's a novel, is I'm just thinking about it all the time. Like I'll have like the general, and when you get a new idea, you're always excited about it. But then sometimes when you think about it, like it starts to fall apart a little bit, or it doesn't excite you as much. But I know if it's going to be a novel, if I just like almost, just keep almost OCD, keep thinking about it. Like when I'm doing other stuff, like it'll just keep coming back to me. I'm like, okay, that's the one I have to figure out why it's, just picking at me. I have to write that one.
And do you, when you sit to, and I'm so fascinated by the process, when you start to write, do you start with chapter one or do you start with the chapter that you can see most clearly? I find that every writer is different. And we're always taught, like, you're going to write consecutive. So you start at the beginning and then you move to the end. But I personally, I bounce. Like, if I can
Yeah.
see, if I wake up and I'm like, I know what chapter 12 is going to look like, I will type that out that day and then I'll figure out what the hell happens before and after it later.
I would say at this point, for maybe half of my novels, I've written like a plot summary first. So sometimes I'll do that. And when I do that, and sometimes it's been professionally forced, like my publisher is like, we're going to offer you a book deal on this partial, but we need to see a summary. And those summaries tend to only be accurate for like the first two thirds of the book. The type of writer I am, I know the beginning and I know the end. The end can be somewhat foggy. Sometimes it's really strong. And for me, like most, is like, how do I get from A to Z? And I do have to write it in order, even though like most of my stuff isn't linear. I write it in the order in which it's going to be. And I never skip ahead to something that excites me because I save that. That's the carrot at the stick for me. It's like, oh, that's the scene. I can't wait to get there to write it. And I have to earn my way to that scene. And for me, that's been like really effective. And maybe off camera, I can tell Elric, since he's read it, like which scene.
I have one exactly in my head when you said those words, and I am curious. It's something quite filmic, and so I'm curious if it's the same, but.
So there's usually like one or two scenes like that where I'm like, oh, but I'll never, because if I skip ahead and write those, I don't think I would write the rest of the book.
So is your outline not that dense? It's like you said, summary, or is this like a really deep outline?
It sort of like depends on the book. Like with the Camathea in the World, I think I wrote like a 10-page summary, but it was sort of forced. So I'd say most of them tend to be like the 10-page-ish area. But even with like Cam is like, does this person, do they die? I don't know. I have to write it to find out. But A Head Full of Ghosts, I had no plot summary. I just started because that felt like the book just landed in my lap. And I didn't start with an outline for a horror movie either. I took a lot of notes. I kind of felt like I outlined as I went. I would write and I would like in my notebook, okay, what do I think is going to happen next? And try to figure out which chapter. And when I finished, I only moved one thing further up into the story. But otherwise, like how you read it is the order in which I wrote it.
That was my next question, is how different does your first draft look from your fourth, or however many you take it through?
Yeah. Writing teachers would probably hate me, but, cause I edit as I go. Like if I'm going good at 500 words a day, and typically what happens is I'll write 500 words and I'll go back and that just slowly starts to expand. And so if it's a novel, I usually go back to the start of a chapter. And so some days it feels like I'm never going to get forward because I'm just like continually adding. And then I add up a little bit and then I kind of creep forward that way. So by the time I've written a full complete draft, I've edited it quite a bit already. So at that point, I'll read through it again a couple times, and usually I print it out, but like major stuff typically doesn't change. It has for some books, but typically when I have the full draft, it's I would say it's close because it goes through the editor after that and first readers and stuff like that. But
The other thing that I definitely want to ask about that I'm fascinated by, what do you do on the days where you just don't feel it? Because we all have those, where you just sit down and you're like, I don't fucking know what happens here. I just want to go back to bed. Like, what do you do? Do you push yourself through it, even though it might not feel good? Or do you just say, fuck it, I'm done for the day, I'm going to go get a pedicure or whatever it is?
I'm sure someday sometimes I give into that, of course, or find something writing related to, but more times than not, I force myself to do it because sometimes the schedule just, I have an hour, I have to do it. So what I found is like, if I say to myself, okay, you're going to sit here for an hour. And if that means you're staring at a blank page, blinking cursor for an hour, then so be it. But that never happens. Like after like a couple of minutes, my subconscious is like, all right, this sucks. Fine. I'll send you some stuff. and a lot of that just comes from practice too. You'd be surprised, or maybe not, because you guys are obviously right. Like, you know, I'm always surprised by like how you train your subconscious, and sometimes not on purpose. Like so many of my like problem solving for stories happens in the shower. Mm-hmm. And partly it's because it happened like once or twice. So I'm like, oh, in the shower is where I figure things out.
Mine's my commute. Yeah. And to the point that I text myself, because I'll get like all of my like, holy shit, I should have done this on my, because it's an hour from Burbank to USC with traffic. And so I have an hour of just sitting idly listening to the radio. And that's so I'll, hey Siri, text Rebecca, and I'll send myself text so that by the time I get back to the computer, it's like right there for me. Because otherwise I won't remember. But yeah, it takes really not thinking about stuff to like think about stuff. If I sit here and I'm just like, what does the character do? Like a lot of times it won't come. But what you're saying, what you were just talking about, like the hour a day, it supports everything that I tell my students and my own personal beliefs about what it takes to be a writer. Like my students are always like, how do I get through 90 pages of a screenplay? How do I write a book? And it, for me, like 75% of it is just discipline. It's just training yourself that I am going to write for 30 minutes a day, even on the days that I don't fucking feel like it. And that it's just, there's this really good writing book that I know a lot of people use when they teach that I love to teach with screenwriting, Bird by Bird. I'm just going to assume you've read it. Have you read Bird by Bird?
I have not.
It's amazing. So I can't even remember who wrote it, but in it, she talks about how all writing is just chipping away slowly. Like nobody sits down and writes a novel in a week. It's just chipping away pages at a time.
Unless you're Stephen Graham Jones.
Unless you're Stephen Graham Jones. And
or
then you
Jeremy
can just...
Robert Johnson. I don't know if you know Jeremy.
Oh, does he
but like,
do that?
He binge writes. He'll lock himself in a hotel for like 4 days and write like 20 hours a day and drink like caffeine drinks. And like, man.
That's how screenplays were written in the 80s with a lot of coke and hotel rooms. And I don't know if people still do that.
Different
I can't
kind of
do that.
I saw that new documentary on Dario Argento, Panico, I think it's called. And it was really cool because that is his process has always been the same. He checks into a fancy hotel and he just stays there until he finishes by himself, has very little interaction with people until he writes something. And it was just fun to see this, you know, elder 80-year-old man checking in and doing the same process. And it was exciting to everyone has a different process.
That's cool. Yeah. No, so he's a marathoner. Like I'm a sprinter. Like Joe Lansdale, I've heard him say like he taps out at 3 hours. He can't do more. You know, he's someone who's been writing forever and has written hundreds of books.
Because I day job and everything else, mine it's scheduled from 8 to 9 every morning. I turn off my phone. I won't answer my emails. I won't take meetings. I write. And then after that, I can continue on with the rest of my day or drive to work or whatnot. So, but it's discipline. It's all the discipline
smart.
Just to get up and do it.
I'm curious about imagination and characters. Like, are they, and this is one thing I think about having a day job that is helpful is you're not just at home in a room all the time. Because I find the interactions I have with people, they don't always become literal characters, but their shadings or the way they talk that always make me go, oh yeah, that, what am I thinking? This is how a 19-year-old's talking now, or somebody you work with. Is that, are characters ever coming from parts of your life, or are you somebody who could sit in a room and just come up with this stuff?
Oh, absolutely. The first, like I imagine myself as a magpie, as a writer, like I'm stealing bits of plastic.
Yeah.
Grass, straw to build the nest. And being a teacher is an amazing, especially high school. Mm-hmm. And I teach at a small private high school. So it's like a daily lesson in voice and slang. It's fun to see like how words will come up and then, you know, they'll last for about 4 years and then something new will take over to mean that same thing. And that slang could be like nationwide. It could be region wide. It could even be like our high school specific because it is such a small school. So,
play Paul Slay.
I would definitely miss that part of it. Not that I'm going to necessarily write like all these books with like 15, 16-year-old boy slang.
I was going to say, are you writing characters with skibbity riz? I think is my kid's newest slang. That
skibbity, haven't heard that one, but riz.
Skibbity,
for sure.
It's like, it means icky, as far as I can tell. I don't know. They just say it a lot.
Yeah. No, and I definitely, I mean, I use much to my family's consternation. Like, you know, I've used them quite a bit. Parents, siblings, my kids. I mean, a head full of ghosts. Mary, 8 year old, was my daughter was eight when I was writing the book. So a ton of her. So much so that like it upset my wife, and that was the last book of mine that she's read. I don't blame her.
I mean, no, that has some disturbing stuff in it. It's a great one. That's one that that hasn't been in some sort of development for years, right? Like different people. I don't know if it's all still
different
changing.
People. Yeah. Same set of producers, Allegiance Theater and Team Downey.
Yeah,
they've had it since 2015. It's come close twice, like really close. And once it fell apart because Focus had left and the new head came in and said, nah. Hmm. And then it probably would have filmed the summer of 2020 with Scott Cooper as the director.
We had a pandemic. Yeah, I remember that.
But we did just renew an option and they have Franz and Fiala as the directors. They did Goodnight Mommy and The Log.
Oh, you said the two names. I thought I was one. Yes. Yeah, they're good stylists.
Yeah, I said it really quickly. Yeah, so it feels like we're ramping up to maybe, hopefully.
Oh, cool.
We'll see.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you had just done a middle grade novel. Could you talk a little bit about the transition from writing for adults to writing middle grade? Because I assume you keep the same level of scare in there usually. Because I love reading middle grade with the kids.
No,
and
I think
they
this
do.
Book
they
is
pack
super...
that same scare in.
Yeah, I think this book is super creepy. For me, I felt like my only concessions to what I usually do with my adult novel is that it's not ambiguous. And the kid overcomes it at the end. If I wrote it as an adult novel, the kid would have been subsumed probably. But like, you know, maybe some vocabulary here and there like had to change, but otherwise I approached it sort of the same way. It features a sixth grade protagonist, a 12-year-old protagonist. And it's called Another. It's sort of like a riff on a Invasion of Body Snatchers kind of story, you know, with some other, you know, differences. And I don't know. I'm excited. So we'll see. We'll see if the kids like it or if they're terrified.
That's absolutely awesome.
We probably talked about it a long time ago, but only because you brought it up again, like rather than telling me what movies were influencing this book, there's obviously millions of types of movies leading it. But like when you were real young, when you weren't reading, were there a handful of those horror films that really, because they're the ones that if they get into your subconscious, I do think they're the ones that kind of lead to style a little bit, whatever your style is in your art.
So growing up, well, you know, pre-cable television, I was born in the early 70s. So we had a program in Massachusetts and Boston called Creature Double Feature on Saturdays. And so the first movie was always a Godzilla, a Gamera, a Kaiju. I just got a Godzilla 1954 head tattoo here, but it hasn't healed yet. So I won't show it until then. So that's what brought me there. But then the second movie was always, it was a Hammer horror film or it was, you know, Attack of the, I got the same. Oh, you got the original.
This has been on my desk for my whole, but it was missing a hand and I
got a replica. Yeah.
I feel so left out, guys. I have a stack of books.
It's my reading mate. It's my, right. We were just showing Godzilla. For those listening to audio only.
No, sorry.
They're showing their Godzilla toys on their desks.
And mine was bigger. So, you know, sorry.
In the original, I know. Mine's fake. Whatever that means. But the second movie is always terrifying. Even the goofy stuff like Attack of the Killer Shrews, which is such an awful movie. But as a kid, I remember having Attack of the Killer Shrews nightmares. But some of the movies that stuck with me that I, you know, refound as an adult. And one, it took me a long time because I couldn't remember the name of the film, but it was Quatermass in the Pit or in the U.S.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Quatermass
is 5 million years to Earth or something like that is the U.S. title or something like that.
It had some nightmare
so
logic.
Up.
In it,
the hand and how it kind of overtakes him.
And
like
the giant
glowing
alien was like I had dreams about that. And it was funny. It was around like 2000. Like, what the hell was the name of that movie? Like, I couldn't figure it out.
Oh, the Quatermass in the Pit, like the giant alien Satan bug creature.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
But also high level productions. That's the thing. Like like a B movie, but it's not shot like the 50s American B movie. It's shot like the fancier Hammer S color and just very beautiful.
I think Hammer actually produced it.
I think they did.
Wonderful movie. Like, I mean, some of the practical effects have aged, but like in terms of story, I mean, you know, John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness references or credits that.
That makes sense.
I mean, Jaws was formative for me when I saw it, and it gave me, I'm not exaggerating, like 10 years of shark nightmares. Mm. Like every dream I had as a kid, I would end up I've seen the movie since over 50 times, but I still cover my face when Quint, sorry, spoiler alert, when Quint gets bitten in half. I've seen way more gorier things, but there's a part of me that just worries if I see that again, it'll return my brain to that 10-year-old brain that saw it the first time.
Now, do you swim in the ocean?
Yeah, but never like, only like if I can still stand under in the water, like I won't go out beyond that.
So no. You swim to sand shark level, but not like great water.
Yes, right. Yeah.
You're not out like full thresher or anything. No. Yeah. I have this like fear push myself thing where I am scared to death, like severely thalassophobic, most likely from Jaws. But yeah. At the same, it's this constant like must face my fear. And so I'm so over my head in the water and probably should not be out that far. But it's this weird kind of fear that Jaws instilled in me. But I also, I love shark movies. It's my favorite subgenre. So
yeah.
I was swimming
and it fucked me up too. And I love it to this day.
Yeah.
I was swimming in a little inlet type beach that looks more like a lake, you know, in Australia. And I was like having the best time ever and swimming for hours and hours. And it was so still. Oh. And then as I got out, I just turned my head and the sign very big says, watch out for sharks, very busy shark area. And I'm just like, so I was probably just swimming with sharks the entire time. Yeah. But the knowledge, and after that, I couldn't go back. It was like, nope.
Yeah. If I were to go to Australia, which I would love to, there is no way I'd be swimming unless it was like something where it's like cordoned off, like fence.
They do some of that, water. But yeah, it is crazy how, would you ever do an animal attack story? Do you think, has those story ideas ever come to you?
I feel like I must have at some point. I
feel like you see them less as novels now than like Cujo or something.
I've definitely written some short stories, but yeah, it's escaping me. Well, I've always wanted to write a giant monster novel, and I've yet to do it, but I've written a ton of giant monster short stories, and I had a weird giant monster anthropomorphic animal novella in last summer's collection, which sort of scratched that itch too. But I don't know, but like, I mean, there are so many movies, but like I was a scaredy cat as a kid. Like I slept with a fortress of stuffed animals around my head.
Same.
Yeah, I love that.
My mom, when she finished reading horror movie, she said, "This is the kid who was afraid of the dark, wrote this disturbing thing." It's like, yeah. So, I mean, in so many of my books, like someone pointed out to me, I realized like there are always scenes where someone's alone in a dark room. Like every book has one of those scenes, and horror movie definitely has that. And like sort of,
That hasn't gone away. As a kid, it was a lot scarier when there weren't people in my house when I was alone. But I remember watching Paranormal Activity 2. I think the one where it's just kind of it was at home, but it was just the one where it's kind of, you're seeing a lot of the security cameras of the house. And I wasn't even particularly scared watching. I was like, this is fine. Turned it off and I was alone in a house. And I just felt it again. Felt like what I remembered being a kid, just like that every creek was infused with something. And
don't you I still have that. Like my garage.
Oh, I totally have.
The steps from my kitchen into my garage, it's 4 steps to get to the light. So you can't turn the light on in the garage until you have gone down 4 steps. And I still, like, I either take them so slow, it's like ridiculous, or I speed run and then flip it up. Like, you know, I'm going to scare the killer who's in my garage with my speed to turn on the lights, because that'll stop them every time. Or I go so slow, being like, well, if I get down 3 steps, you know, that's better than all 4 when the killer attacks. Like I still have that weird, and I'm not doing it every time where I'm consciously thinking about the killer, but I still do that speed run to the light switch every fucking time.
See, I don't imagine a killer. I still imagine like some sort of ghost weird thing.
I think that's one of the most fascinating things about people. Like I remember hearing John Landis talk about it, like how some people, kids who are like, you know, probably some of us, are creeped out by supernatural things. He would always talk about how his wife and people are only scared of practical, real things that could happen, like a serial killer, a person entering your home. But that doesn't even enter my, like, I have zero concern about real people, even though they're terrible.
Really?
People can be terrible, but I'm not worried. But I am worried that a ghost could, come again.
I've never had a ghostly experience. Alaric and I have talked about this on the show before, whereas he's had like, you know, questionable supernatural weirdness happen. I have never had one thing where I could be like, that was messed up. I don't know about that. Whereas I have been scared to death of people. I had a peeping Tom outside my house when I lived in North Hollywood. That fucked my shit up. So anytime I hear a creak in the house, it's that axe murderer. Like it's never a ghost. It's the axe murderer. So have you had supernatural events that kind of push towards that?
No. No, I mean, obviously, there are times like you think about, like, is it a home invasion? No, it's, you know, I feel like I have boring answers. Like, I don't believe in ghosts. Most, I say like 99% of the time, but there's that 1% where I freak myself out. And then I'm like, ah, you're so being so stupid. And I never scare myself writing, except there was one time I was writing a ghost story for Ellen Datlow. And I was at the end of the story. And the story was literally, the character was me, essentially, a writer. And the writer is hearing a noise upstairs in his room. I was here. It was summer, bright sunlight, but I was the only one home with my dog. And as I was writing the story about the writer hearing a loud noise upstairs, there was a loud boom upstairs, a loud bang. And that I had the classic physical fear response. Like, I've never had like the hair thing. So I grabbed a baseball bat and I grabbed my dog, who's only 15 pounds. I don't know what I was going to do with my dog, throw her at the supernatural being.
She'll lick him to death.
It took a lot for me to get upstairs. And I did. But so in the kid's bathroom, a shampoo bottle had just fallen. Like, I don't know why. It was a window open. I don't remember. But yeah, that was a strange.
I want to see the flash cut to the scariest creature you've ever seen. And he's just like pushing your shampoo bottle. Yeah. He's like, that will get him.
He's like, take that. It's like Ghost, where they have to muster up all their strength to push it. All he's got is that shampoo bottle, but it messed you up.
I find cats are the scariest to me, because you'll be sitting late at night watching something, a cat like looks up at you, but then it looks just over your shoulder and just won't look away from something, and I'm always like, god damn it, this is like you're the creepiest damn cat. So I find them to be quite creepy in that way.
No, my dog is creepy because she's older now too, like an elderly dog. And so sometimes, like, if I'm home alone, she doesn't do it when people are home, just if it's me and her. She'll go and stand and, like, stare at the wall. Like, what are you doing? Or just stare out, like, down the dark hallway. Like, what are you looking at?
Yeah.
You can't hear anything anymore. Stop it.
Yeah, no, it's unsettling. But I think it's good that we still have, you still have to have that ability to be scared get to this stuff.
No doubt. Well, Paul, I know you have school in the morning, so we're going to let you go, but thank you so much for joining us here. So we've got horror movie coming out June 11th. What's the next book that you have coming out after this? Is it the adolescent one?
Yeah, so it'd be the middle grade. Will be out summer 2025. Yeah, called Another. But yeah, horror movie. And I am going on like an actual U.S. tour with a book for the first time. So LA, but... San Francisco, which I've never been to, so I'm excited.
Wearing a mask the whole time? Like a creep?
No mask. I know, I should come up with some sort of prop.
A gimmick.
I have to think about that.
We're not going to have time to talk about the like horror films about filmmaking, but there was one I wanted to check to see if you had seen it, just because I think it's one of the best, and it just got released for the first time on Shudder, and this is one that me and Beck have loved for years, but have you seen Mute Witness?
Oh, so good.
No, I know of it. Okay. Is it Russian?
It's American, shot in Russia.
But Russia. Okay,
shooting a movie in Russia, even though the cast and crew are mostly American. I mean, it might be Serbia or something like, but it's out there. And then it basically, after hours, when they leave the set, two of the guys from the film come in and shoot what equates to a snuff film. And I just think you would really dig it. It didn't remind me of your book, but when we were going to detail some of these, I wanted to bring it up because partially it's been not the easiest to see all these years, and it is now brand spanking new, released on Shudder. I think that you should watch it, because I think you'll dig it.
Yeah,
I've obviously heard of the movie and read about it. I think it was always like, ooh, that might be too scary for me.
It's pretty intense, but I think it's fun. It's a Hitchcockian kind of thing. Yeah,
it's a tight thriller. Yeah, it feels real De Palma-y. Yeah. So,
one last movie thing. So the Barnes & Noble, please support your independent bookstores, but Barnes & Noble is also publishing an exclusive edition of Horror Movie.
Nice.
So I wrote like a 11-page like liner notes, like the making of the book kind of thing. But I also did an essay of my favorite sort of overlooked films.
Oh, cool.
As well. So, I got to name like a whole bunch. So for movie fans, maybe hopefully you might find one or two in there that either you haven't seen or you find.
You have a shelf at Barnes & Noble, right? I assume you do. I was at the last night. I went to a book signing for my friend Josh Pruitt, writes The Last Comics on Earth, middle grade graphic novel. Mm. And I went to his book signing at the Barnes & Noble in Glendale last night.
Oh, because I've signed books there. So like they like me now. Yeah.
Oh, I went through. I got Sister Maiden Monster, which I haven't read yet. I'm excited to dive into that.
Yeah,
one.
Lucy Snyder. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. I just picked it up last night. But as I was going through the horror stuff, I was like, oh, Paul, it's like King Campbell and then Tremblay, and you have a shelf with a nameplate there now.
Oh, wow.
Really impressive.
Oh, well, that's so cool to hear. Thanks. Yeah. Well, my son went to school at Occidental. He graduated last year.
Super close. Yeah.
When he was there, I stayed in the hotel like across the street from that Barnes and Noble. So I was always,
three
I was in there
stories.
a couple times a year.
I think the last time we met you, you were out here looking at colleges for him or something.
He was looking at colleges. That's right.
And he was, So anyway, congrats. This was a really fun read and a really dark, and like, it does the kind of like the weird movie you're looking for that's really fucked up and goes to a dark place. It has that quality. So,
yes,
so you did it.
Yes, thank you.
Oh my gosh.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us, Paul. And thank you all so much for listening. If you need to hear some super weird titles during our off week, please find us on our Patreon show, Deep Cuts, for all of your weird horror selections. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with another exciting show. The Colors of the Dark podcast is a Fangoria production. Producers and co-hosts are Rebecca McKendry and Elric Kane. Executive producers are Tara Ainsley and Abby Gould. Sonic branding by Michael Rodriguez. And, of course, our amazing sound engineer, Ernie Hurtado.